fires that are around my county tonight, watching the Tooele fire and the interactions between people with the ODF and the Forest Service, and I couldn't have been prouder, happier, and more pleased by the way ODF has pushed on a fire that they've lost management of. It's gone to a federal management. But the ODF team was fast responding and was there. And as the ODF, as the Forest Service came in and took over, ODF has continued to be there. And they've been arguing for and asking for the permission to do things slightly differently than the Forest Service had planned to do them. And when that didn't go through, they argued again to do it that way. And they finally did, and they're protecting some private property owners by engaging the fire in a different manner than it might have been in resources put in different places. And I so appreciate ODF standing up and doing what they believe is right to fight these fires. And I know how hard it is. I don't know how hard it is. But I have fought fires with a volunteer fireman. My son-in-law's a fireman. He's a lieutenant out of a unit that has a tender. And so they're out often. So I don't know it personally, but I know it must be hard on a family to be engaged in those fires, hard on the person to be engaged in that type of work every single day, and then not to be able to protect the lands, the private property lands that they are wanting to do in the way they want to do it. I appreciate them arguing, and I appreciate them pressing, and I appreciate them ultimately being allowed to go forward and protect, in this case, Justina, and a couple of other people's lands down there up to deliver, and I thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Lois. Very appreciate it. On to the State Forester and our Protection Division Chief.
Just keep it out of my county. It's still not in my line. Just keep it out of my county.
So Will mentioned that he wanted to say a few words. And so,
I apologize.
No. So then I told him I'd find a spot. I thought public comment about that. This would be as good a time as any. So if you don't apologize, I ask you.
Dave Yamamoto, Tillamook County Commissioner.
Catherine Sullivan, Platte County Commissioner.
Susan Gordon, AOC staff.
John Sweet, who's panel?
The AOC board.
Liz Denton, State Forest Division Chief.
Tom Emerson, North Forest Street.
Darren Sullivan, State Forest Engineer.
Jeffrey Furman, Forest Inventory Coordinator with State Forest.
Roger McFabe, I'm the Ceiling and Reforestation Specialist for the State Forest Division.
Mike Cody, West Oregon District Forester.
I'm Cindy Colomato of the State Forest Division.
Clark Fox, Clackamas Conservation District.
Rick Roon, Clackamas County, representing my county commissioners.
Seth Barnes, the Oregon Forest Industries Council.
Joe Travers, Oregon Department of Forestry, Tillamook.
Mark Rasmussen, Mason Preserver.
Jim McCauley, Washington County.
Simon Hare, Josephine County Commissioner, Public Lands Co-Chair for AOC.
Kenny White, Northwest Oregon Area Director.
Jason Cox, ODF, Health Affairs, State Forest.
So, in terms of open comments, today there's going to, the department has put together a very impressive document that gives a pretty thorough assessment of what is out there. And going through this is some information that I learned for the first time, and of course, which always leads to wanting more information. But there's just an awful lot there, and for the county commissioners, I ask you to pay close attention to this. Take this document home, keep it as a resource, and because when I'm gone, you're going to need this information. Lots of really, really good information. So I want to thank the department for putting this together. Peter Doherty couldn't make it today. He has to be in Portland. And so he gives his apologies. And we have our chair, Board of Forestry Chair. Thank you. We always appreciate that. When we go through the assessment document, I think what we will do is, because there's so much to be covered, it's going to take about an hour and a half, we'll, when we finish this segment, then we'll stop and ask if there are questions. So we won't do this in an effort to try to keep on course. And then I'm going to be really careful that the questions that are asked are in line with comments that I wanted to make. Any comments that you wanted to make? John?
Well, just briefly, yes, Peter is actually the, he'll be head of Portland. He's also has the legislative update with respect to the fire situation, which is obviously important. I appreciate the chance to be here today, though. This work that you're getting today is really, as Tim said, is really important. The Board of Forestry will be getting this at the September 5th meeting, so it's a nice chance for me to get a preview or demo. Maybe if I hear it enough times, it will sink in a little bit better, too. But you'll see us over the next several months digging into goals, strategies, measurable outcomes, and policy decisions. A lot of that emanates from the work you'll be getting today, and it's important for us to be doing this to continue our work on the forest management plan. We're committed to marching forward with that, as I think you know. And as we do that, you know, this is one opportunity, and you'll also have opportunities at the board meetings to present perspectives that, and that's a practice, obviously, that will continue and will be valued. So hopefully that we encourage robust engagement, I guess I'd say, as we look at that.
One of the things that, in reading through this, one of the things that I'm going to bring up with the Board of Forestry is the current science. There are four studies now that really indicate that current forest practices, whoever, under whatever plan, they work from BLM, U.S. Forest Service, State Forest, and Forest Practices Act, not harming fish, not harming water, actually helping them, is really impressive information. And we need to, as often as we can, get that information out in the public. There are people don't want to hear it, but we need to keep giving that information. So anyway, that's one of the things that I want to talk about when we get down to the bottom of this, but giving an overview of the current science, just to make sure that everybody's aware of it. So now I think we're at the minutes, approval of the minutes.
Move approval.
Second. Any further discussion? All those in favor,
aye.
By saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right, and public comments. Any public comments?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to take a second. My name is Simon Herrick, Josephine County Commissioner and liaison to public lands for the county.
I want you to sit there permanently for me today.
No, I'm just going to.
I know, but you're a county commissioner, you're a trustee.
Yeah, no, I'm fine. Mr. Chair, I appreciate it.
There's going to be a big presentation.
Yeah,
sure. So we're not going to let you sit. Dan, we're going to let you agree.
No, real quick, though. I appreciate the fire map that ODF put out last year. It was around the Oregonian, and it really showcased the fire propensity to Southern Oregon and Josephine County. And we've known that for a long time, but I don't know if the rest of the state did until the Oregonian highlighted it. We don't get to ship our smoke up to Portland as often as I'd like. But I just can't say enough about the protection that ODF has done for county forest lands and private lands in my county, and also to emphasize the need for all of us in this room to really lean into the effort of the contract with the BLM in the next year. That was too much at the last minute for us down in Southern Oregon. I think the rest of the state, you guys do the best job of protecting these lands, and it needs to kind of continue that way. So I just couldn't say enough.
Sam, there's a chair right there.
Please. Well, I'll grab my stuff.
See, it kept working on it. I think several of us have just come here from the Coastal Caucus held in Lincoln City. And one of the issues covered there was global warming and what can be done about global warming. I was very interested in comments made by the lead-off forum on this matter. These were comments by Chadwick Oliver, director of Yale's Global Institution of Sustainable Forestry and Pinchot Professor of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale.
He laid out four things that we could be doing, each of which would reduce global warming or CO2 emissions by 20%, according to his rough calculations, assuming it's pretty rough. And the first one was to displace as much as we possibly can concrete and steel with wood when it comes to our buildings. So, you know, we do a lot of things here, like not cut down trees because of environmental concerns, but here's an over, almost an overriding environmental concern that could be addressed by more timber farms.
The other thing that came out in that discussion, Slid was talking about, I don't remember who, but one of the CLT buildings that was built, all the wood came from British Columbia. So that's how we got it. We harvesting our own trees.
It's not very environmental to be shipping wood into the United States. My further points, not only British Columbia, but also Chile and New Zealand, China, when we have the material here at home, close to the markets to provide for housing.
So,
to pursuing potential opportunities for collaboration in Clackamas County between county lands, our county forest lands, state forest lands, and a project we're pursuing with the U.S. Forest Service lands. And we have a great opportunity to share those efforts and talk about getting together in the near future to for those collaborations, particularly around what was just mentioned, cross-laminated timber, and getting more supply into the supply chain provides some greater certainty so that we can attract more investment in the infrastructure on the side of it, not only processing of potential panels, but also the need for increased kiln capacity to be able to supply the lumber for those processing. But again, as you said, commissioners, is we've got the resource here in throughout all of Western Oregon and throughout a lot of Oregon to supply that without having to pull it in from Canada and Germany and so forth. So thank you for the opportunity to do this.
Anybody else?
Okay.
You want to take it over from here?
Yes. I'm going to move over here with the team because we have a tag team approach to our presentation today. So in the material we sent out a few weeks ago, there was at that point a draft copy of the staff report that is in the Board of Forestry material now as a final draft. So that is the sort of written word, if you will, that goes along with the presentation that we're giving today. There are a few points I'd like to make as we get started here. First of all, this has been a huge team effort. And so you can, as evidenced by the folks we have here at the table, we're very fortunate to have really a highly capable, well-trained technical staff here with a lot of experience, boots on the ground, working under the current plan and across our entire forest land base. And they've done an incredible job of digging in and doing the analysis to help us understand the condition of our forests across the landscape. So as we've been working on this presentation, we've gone, you know, where we've ended now is, while there are other subject matter experts in the room that covered and did the analysis of parts of this presentation, several of us are covering that material for those staff members, because otherwise there would be, I don't know, four other people or so up here. So I just first want to really make that acknowledgement of the whole team. All our names are listed here. And as we move through the presentation, each of the folks here will introduce themselves. So first of all, this piece. So in terms of what we're trying to do today, we will spend some time reviewing, the goal of today is to review our draft forest resource assessment. This analysis is required by the planning rule. We've talked with you all about that a couple times. There are a number of factors that the planning rule establishes for what has to be included in the forest management plan. A resource assessment is one of those. As we finalize this work, it will become an important foundation, as Tom mentioned, for our proposal for strategies for a potential revised forest management plan, and it'll also be the foundation for the comparative analysis of a proposed plan to the current plan that will inform the board's decision making. So we have a lot to cover today. Tim mentioned that, and much of the information is complex. We've organized our presentation to provide an overview of the given resources, and then provide a district-by-district comparison, because one of the key messages you'll see as we move through here is the variability across the landscape. So I've listed the resources there on the left side of the slide there. I'm not going to read through them. You can see them for yourselves. But the analysis is covering all of our ownership west of the Cascades. So that includes our Astoria, Tillamook, Forest Grove, North Cascades, West Oregon, Western Lane, districts, our Coos unit, and we'll talk a little bit about that here later, and our Southwest Oregon district. At the end of each of the segments on the individual resource conditions, we'll provide you with a brief summary. We'll answer some questions to clarify what's going on, get input on what you think, you know, we need to be included as we move to a final version, if you think we've missed something. And then we'll move to the next topic. And then at the end of the presentation, we will provide a district-by-district lens. As you layer all these different resources in each district, you kind of get a different story, and so we need to, this is a great opportunity to share that. So again, what you're going to see is there is a very wide range of conditions and a high degree of variability across the landscape in between our districts. Yes.
Probably ought to say something.
Of course.
John reminded me of this. If you have comments about what you read and about the information that's given to you, I think that's highly appropriate. But if you start talking about things that deal specifically with forest management, you ought to be careful because of the ongoing litigation.
I appreciate that. And really, today is foundational information. So you'll see we're not really getting into policies.
Yes. Before we start up again, would this be available on a computer?
A digital version of the presentation?
Correct.
Certainly. Yeah, we can make that. Yeah, of course.
It should be part of our, if you look at our September 5th board meeting, that was assumed this will be linked there.
Yeah, exactly, online at the board website.
Okay.
The revision, but I can certainly make that. I can send it to the committee here as well. Okay. So a theme, just sort of setting the stage for y'all, is diversity, and this will play out over and over again for each resource that we talk about. So you know, from my perspective, as we consider management goals and expected outcomes, it'll be important to take this variability into account. So a little bit about the before I go to there. Finally, I talked with Tim about this morning a little bit. You'll see that we have a particularly unique situation in our Tillamook district, in which forest conditions, fish and wildlife, slope, soils, fire history, public use all combine to present significant challenges, and it's really going to require us to think critically and creatively about what some of our opportunities and solutions might be in that context. So with that, I will provide you a brief history of the lands. We could spend a lot of time on this, but I decided to keep it short today. So the bulk of our Board of Forestry lands that we manage today were cut over and burned in the 1930s and 40s. Legislation in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, known as the Forest Acquisition Act, provided for state acquisition of these lands in order to ensure the lands would remain as forest lands and be managed to provide greatest permanent value to the state. The lands were acquired for the most part when the counties deeded tax delinquent lands to the state in exchange for a source of the future revenue, and I know that you're all familiar with this. Through a bond measure, the state engaged in a massive reforestation and restoration efforts, particularly for the areas covered in the Tillamook burn. And the efforts spanned from the 1940s to the 1970s and covered over 250,000 acres, so a significant effort, and we'll talk a little bit about the outcome of that today.
And the county paid that bond back. The first few years as a county commissioner, I remember when we actually reached that milestone when it was all paid off.
That was significant. The restoration effort that took place in those years created the forests that we have today, which are still relatively young. So in terms of ownership patterns, the division manages approximately six. Oh, I'm sorry. To go back. No, I'm sorry. I apologize. When we cover the material today, the material that we're covering today and the analyses that we did are for, as I said, our districts that are west of the Cascades, and so that's all shown there with the blue land base on the map. And you'll see we've pointed out the Gilchrist Forest and the Sun Pass State Forest there in the lower right hand or the east side of the state. And those acres are not included. When you hear us talk about acreages, and all forest condition information, the resource condition does not include the Sun Pass and the Gilchrist. So at this point, we're focusing our efforts on those land base that's west of the Cascades.
What is that acreage and what's the eastern Oregon acreage?
So the material we're covering today is about 640,000 acres. So that's about 100,000 acres on the east side that remains. And that's an estimate. Something like that, yeah.
One third, yeah, on the east side.
We can give you the exact number. So in terms of ownership patterns, it matters how the land is distributed in the districts that we're managing. So most of the blocked up lands are on the Clatsop and Tillamook State Forest, so Astoria, Tillamook, and Forest Grove districts. For approximately 494,000 acres, or about 80% of the land base. These forests also constitute, in those regions, the majority of the public lands in the Northwest Oregon area and region of the state. The other districts are complemented by much more federal land surrounding them, and so you'll see how that flavors the resources that we're managing on those districts. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Darren. He'll introduce himself.
Thank you, Liz. So I'm Darren Cohen. I'm the State Forest Engineer. And I will be presenting the geology, the soils, and the roads and access segment. So in the geologic context of our planning area sets the foundation for the hows and the whys of the biologic environment and the forest management occurring there. It directly controls the soils and the topography of our land. I'm not going to dive deeply into geology and plate tectonics and erosive processes, other than to say that these are the processes which are forming and continue to shape the terrain of our planning area. The take-home message here is that the majority of the lands we're talking about today are in this Coast Range area, with the outlier being the our North Cascade Stiff Streets over in the foothills of the Cascade Range. In the North Coast Range, there's a mixture of marine basalts and Columbia River basalts and marine sediments. These formations have been uplifted by tectonic forces, and the softer marine sediment components are being eroded through rainfall, stream flow, downcutting, and landslide events. From the mid-coast and south, there are very few marine volcanic materials, and geology is largely composed of marine sedimentary formations. And then our North Cascade District is primarily volcanic in origin.
Which erodes at a different rate?
Yes. So management choices affect soils directly and must be matched to soil conditions at the given site to preserve the soil layer and water quality. Soil types can influence things like road building, soil productivity, and the character of sediments and streams. Soil grain size is related to the underlying geology. Here we see in blue shading that due to the influence of volcanic rock, Tilma, Forest Grove, and North Cascade districts have predominantly coarse grain soils. The underlying geology for the other districts is predominantly sedimentary rock, which produces fine grain soils, represented by green on the chart. It should be noted that although the Astoria District consists of primarily fine grain soils from sedimentary geology, the district also has, or is characterized by a number of basaltic dikes and or intrusions in the form of dikes and seals. And these intrusions are important sources of rock for the Astoria District. So what are some of the management factors related to operating in fine grain and coarse grain soils? For roads, fine grain soils are more sensitive to deterioration during wet weather. When providing for extended operating seasons, this requires additional rock and the employment of additional best management practices to protect water quality. For reforestation, the coarse grain cobbly soils often require different planting stock and tools than on fine grain soils. And for timber growth, site productivity tends to be higher on units with the fine grain soil. Let's talk some about slope steepness. Slope steepness affects all aspects of forest management. For example, training composed of slopes less than 30% have lower management costs, whereas slopes over 60% have higher management costs. There's also a greater potential for erosion and, in some instances, landslides, both of which must be considered to protect watershed processes and stream conditions. Here we have a series of two slides to compare how the geology and erosive processes have created very different topography. Steep slopes are represented in dark blue, while the gentler slopes are represented in green. So in the upper picture, we have a shot of our LIDAR imagery from the Astoria District. Shows most of the slopes are pretty gentle. In the lower picture, we have a shot of the Tilma District, and the landscape is dominated by steep slopes. Well, these are small portions of each district. These are indicative of the districts as a whole. Here we have topography viewed in another way, as the number of acres in the low, moderate, and steep slope categories. One can see major differences in the district distribution for the very steep slopes in blue. Overall, one-third of the planting area has slopes greater than 60%, making all aspects of forest management on these slopes more expensive. The Tillamook District has a significant number of acres with slopes greater than 60%. And Western Lane District and Hughes Unit also have a relatively large percentage of land base with slopes greater than 60%. The primary difference between the Tillamook District and the Western Lane and Hughes Unit is that the slope runs on the Tillamook District are generally longer. That'd be the distance from the top of the ridge down to the valley bottom. So a summary of our geology and soils. Underlying geology determines our soil type. Soils formed from volcanic current materials are more coarse grained. These tend to have lower site potential but less erosive potential. Soils formed from sedimentary current materials are finer grained. These tend to have higher site potential but more erosive potential. The Tillamook District has some challenges, including large percentage of steep slopes, longer slope runs, and additional protection strategies to address erosion processes. Next, I will move into the roads and access portion.
Before we do that, any questions?
So this kind of referred to this in her opening slides, that the North Coast units are more blocked up in nature. The remaining districts are more scattered in nature. Scattered ownerships have a higher management complexity. From a erosion access standpoint, scattered tracts require more access agreements, and we generally have less control over the transportation network. There are other management complexities related to scattered tracts, which we'll hear about in other portions of the presentation. But briefly, these include increased property boundary issues and surveys. There's less flexibility in harvest unit planning. There's an increased complexity in site preparation and young stand management. Excuse me. And varied constraints and abilities to manage wildlife and aquatic species. I have a few metrics to describe the condition of the existing access system. This first one looks at the percent of the land base that is within a quarter mile of road. The key take-home point here is that state forests are working for us, and the transportation has been pretty well developed and maintained to provide for meeting the management objectives of greatest permanent value. And we are mandated by statute to manage the Board of Forestry lands to provide for the greatest current value. In the remaining slide, you might hear us call this GPV. So if you hear that, that's what we're calling it. So this metric, I looked at the percent of the road network that is surface, and the key point here is that we have available rock on our North Coast districts and our North Cascade districts. And on our other districts, we don't have rock. We have a little bit on the Southwest Oregon, but the Western Oregon, Western Lane, and Coos, we don't have rock sources, so we have to purchase our rock. Surface roads provide greater opportunity for extended operating seasons. Increased water or protection of water quality and better access for recreational opportunities, which are all components of meeting GPV. Excuse me, we're getting on track here. So as I mentioned before, our the districts that don't have rock, they have to purchase it from commercial sources, and it. Generally, we have to truck it longer distances, so our cost of rock roads are more expensive, and that's why you'll see this percentage of roads surface lower in those districts. Along with that, when you have scattered ownerships and you don't control the entire road system, those investment decisions are different than when you can control the whole road system. Okay. So this metric was to look at the percent of the road network within 100 feet of streams. Protection of water quality is a primary component of the Forest Practices Act and of providing for GPD. One facet of protecting water quality is to minimize road locations near streams and to apply best management practices for those segments of road near water to minimize the potential for sediment debris. While the overall percent of the road network near the stream network is low, the road investments are generally higher in these critical areas. These investments include infrastructure such as bridges and fish passage culverts, as well as application of best management strategies employed to reduce potential for sediment delivery to streams. The last metric I looked at, this is the roads on slopes steeper than 60%. Compared to the actual percent of the acreage on slopes steeper than 60%. A couple of key messages here. The percent of the road network on slopes greater than 60% is significantly less than the percent of the land base on slopes greater than 60%. That's not by accident. We minimize locating roads on steep slopes, minimize potential for landslides, and potential delivery of sediments to water. When we do have to locate roads on these slopes, we utilize best management practices for construction and maintenance to minimize risk. These best management practices have significantly higher costs per foot of road compared to roads on gentler slopes. The Tillamook District has some unique conditions with steep slopes, long slope runs, and as we'll get into later, lower value stands. These make transportation planning a unique challenge in the Tillamook District. Much of the Western Lane District and the Q's Unit are in sandstone formations, which require additional care in road location, construction, and maintenance to minimize the risk of contributing to shallow, rapid flowing debris slides. Our key points for the roads and access. The transportation system is fairly well developed for the planning area, more so for the blocked up ownerships than for the scattered ownerships. Where rock is available and we control the majority of the transportation network, a large percentage of the road network has been rock, providing for extended operating seasons, increased protection of water quality, and these contribute to meeting the goals of GPD. Steep slopes, long slope runs, and high stream density and lower valley stands on the Tillamook District present unique challenges for transportation and unit planning. And sandstone formations and steep slopes on Western Lane and Coos also require extra care and transportation planning to minimize the risk of shallow, rapid debris flows. And I'll take any questions or comments.
Any questions? I have one. Getting back to the percent of roads within 100 feet of streams,
mm-hmm.
you have data that goes back maybe 30, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. How these numbers have changed, the percentages have changed over time?
I think we could probably get to some estimate of that, but it has been a focus to where we can to move our roads away from the stream network and eliminate crossings where possible.
Which is my point. I think that it would be nice if you had another slide involved in this to show how you're progressing over time to minimize the number of roads within 100 feet of streams. To minimize sedimentation concerns.
Okay. Yeah, probably I will be passing on to Jeff Furman now.
Thanks, Jeff. My name is Jeffrey Furman. I'm the Forest Inventory Coordinator at the State Forest. Mm-hmm. Can you figure out how to plug this back in?
Oh.
passing the board's condition and the board's town. Based on our most recent forest inventory estimates, the total standing volume throughout the entire assessment area is a little bit more than 16 billion merchantable board feet, as measured in the net scribbler volume. However, some of that volume is inaccessible to timber harvest due to physical limitations related to logging systems, road building, regulatory protection stemming from the Oregon Forest Practices Act and the Endangered Species Act further limit where harvesting can occur. Then when you factor in riparian standards and take avoidance strategies, coupled with the landscape design and terrestrial anchor policies that are in our current forest management plan, you do the math and all of a sudden find that less than 8 billion merchantable board feet remain without any specific harvest constraints applied to them. So roughly half of the total standing volume. Before we dig too much into that, let's take a step back and concentrate more on the forest resource that we manage as opposed to the management of that forest resource. The average forest acre throughout the assessment area has about 27,000 to 28,000 board feet to the acre, but some of those have two or three times that volume and others have no commercial volume at this time. So basically that volume is distributed.
Can you folks hear him?
Yeah, I'm having a hard time.
All right, I'll speak up a bit.
Did you say 2,700 board feet or square feet?
The total is 16 billion across the assessment area. The average is 27,000 to the acre.
27,000 board feet.
Correct. We're talking net scribbler volume. Move up the measures. So, again, this volume is distributed unevenly throughout the landscape. Each state forest district and each forest span on the ownership is unique. When you take a closer look, some patterns emerge.
Before you move on, can you back up a little bit? So the difference between the 16 billion merchantable board feet and the standing volume versus 8 billion available board volume, that takes it. You're taking into account steep slopes and things in Petaluma County where they're really not accessible. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. That would be the physical limitations for current logging and road building technology cannot get
in. Current road building technology, yes.
Correct.
Thank you.
Is the volume better now? Thank you.
So, looking at the age distribution here, as a result of their history of large fires, extensive logging of old growth timber, and intensive forest management, state forest lands currently have an uneven age distribution. Stand age is a major influence on the current condition of these forests, and this uneven age distribution has significant implications as it relates to the forest management plan. You can see from this age distribution, forest stands in the 50 to 79 year old range are the most abundant across the assessment area. This bubble is so sweet, coinciding with periods of aggressive salvage logging and subsequent reforestation efforts that occurred after the Tillamook burn. Consequently, that 50 to 79 year old age group now accounts for half of the total acreage in the assessment area, more than 60% of the total standing volume. Now, while stand age is a major factor that can help predict the stand's current condition, it certainly is not the only one. Site productivity, past management practices, and disturbance in disease history all are interacting with one another to yield the forest that we see on the landscape today. Again, every forest stand is unique, but grouping those stands into forest types can be a useful tool to help us observe natural trends that play out across a complex landscape. Forest types based on species composition inform us about a stand's potential future condition, and then the age of each of those stands reveals where that stand lies on its development curve. Douglas fir, as we all know, is the predominant species throughout Oregon State Forest, but the landscape actually supports a wide variety of forest types. In fact, even though more than two-thirds of the stand volume in the assessment area is comprised of Douglas fir, less than half of the total acreage fits into that description of a single species, monotypic. Sure, other conifer species, especially western hemlock, also cover portions of the landscape, sometimes mixed in
finally hardwood species, especially red alder, comprise another major component of the state forest landscape. We know that there will be assessing area containing a significant hardwood component. It's clear that takes into account stands that are dominated by hardwood, which would be put far on that chart, as well as stands that contain a mixture of conifer and hardwood species in the fifth bar. So every stand is unique, but in general, each of these four different forest types will be different in that they will present distinct silvicultural challenges, they will offer varied economic opportunities, and they can provide unique habitat potential. In the next two slides, we will explore the differences between these forest types, first from the perspective of habitat development, and then from the perspective of timber production. So different forest types will vary with respect to their potential for wildlife habitat development. Soto will cover this topic in more detail later in the presentation, but here we will focus on habitat development in the context of forest types. In the current plan, we use forest structure to characterize wildlife habitat. The layered and older forest structure, that would be LYR, OFS in the chart there, those stand types together comprise the portion of the landscape that we typically refer to as complex. This chart here shows the total acres by forest type across the assessment area, just like the previous one, but now a black bar has been added to represent the number of acres that are currently in layered in OFS.
Layered or aspired to be in layered in older forest structure?
That's the current condition of the forest. Right, we've got map condition.
Jeff, make sure you stay close enough to your mic there.
Oh, sure.
So, I'm sorry, the dark bar represents both of those?
Yes, if you combine those two categories, that would be represented by the dark bar, and then everything else in each of those bars would be the other.
Thank you.
So, as you can see, the mixed conifer forest type represents just a quarter of the total land base, yet it provides about half of the total acres currently in layer NFS. Overall, about a quarter of the total mixed conifer acres are currently in complex, as compared with less than 10% of the Douglas fir downwood acres. By definition, mixed conifer stands can be multi-species stands that are more prone to developing layered canopies. For similar reasons, the conifer hardwood forest type also contributes disproportionately to the total acres in layered. Timber production potential, these different forest types will also vary with respect to their potential to produce timber. To consider forest condition in the context of timber production, I've analyzed net Scribner board volume per acre for forests that stands in the 50 to 79 year old range. There's a lot of information on this graph, but let's focus on the median and range for each of these forest types. For the Douglas fir, the mixed conifer, and the conifer hardwood forest types, median, as represented by the dashed line, hovers around 30,000 board feet to the acre. The median for the hardwood dominant stands is predictably quite a bit lower. With respect to the range of conditions, 90% of the mixed conifer stands, so now we're looking from down here to up here, 90% of the mixed conifer stands have between 10,000 and 60,000 board feet to the acre. That's quite a bit of variability, but that's what I'm explaining. That range is quite a bit narrower for all other stand types, although it appears to be comparable for Douglas fir dominant stands. As we would expect, these two conifer types, Douglas fir and mixed conifer, really stand out as having the greatest potential for timber production, with stands regularly producing upwards of 40 or even 50,000 to the acre. Now let's take a look at Douglas fir. Realistically, this is what the market wants. This is where we consistently see the highest demand for our timber sales, and this is where we consistently receive our highest bid prices. Interestingly, this is where the forest types really start to differentiate from one another. If you compare the all-species chart on the left, Douglas fir only volume chart on the right, Doug fir dominant box is barely moved. Access issues aside, this is where our highest value timber sales are. We've got the single wood species, high stumpage, relatively straightforward silviculture, and plain bottom. you move on to that second box in each of those drugs, that would be the mixed conifer, all of a sudden things have started to change from the first reaction to the second one. We're talking about multiple bid species, heavier whitewood, a little bit more complicated subculturally. There's still plenty of volume there, and in some cases plenty of Douglas fir. And most of these stands are still very valuable in the context of timber production. They're just not quite as valuable on average as the Douglas fir dominant stands.
Whitewood is hemlock.
It would really be any merchantable conifer, so it could be hemlock, it could be true fir, spruce, and cedar, including that as well.
All under the category of whitewood?
For the purpose of this analysis, yes. We're talking Doug fir and other, and as we break out these different forest types, that's the indicator of the and then as you move on to the conifer hardwood type there, the hardwood dominant, many stands do have a lot of value still for timber production, but overall the value and the economic return from sales in those types will go down. So now let's take a look at the distribution of these four forest types across the landscape. Due to a variety of geographical and historical factors, these four forest types are not distributed evenly across the district coverage by the Douglas fir dominant forest type ranges from about a third of the total acreage in Tillamook up to about two-thirds of the total acreage in Forest Grove and West Oregon. The Astoria district really stands out for mixed conifer forest type. This type is also very common in North Cascade and Southwest Oregon districts, but the species mixes will be different there as compared to what we're seeing on the North Coast. Tillamook is the district that leads the path for the hardwood. For kind of hardwood mixes, Western Lane also has a lot of this, but again, we talk about different species mixes than we see on the North Coast. So before we discuss that fourth type, the hardwood dominant type, let's zoom into those three North Coast districts. So despite their close proximity to one another, these three districts really couldn't be more different from one another. This is clearly an oversimplification, but generally speaking, Forest Grove, Douglas fir, Astoria, mixed conifer, Tillamook, hardwood. With respect to Tillamook, the district, roughly half, or fully half the district, contains a significant hardwood component, as everybody is too far here. In fact, when you're looking at that hardwood dominant type, Tillamook contains more than three times as many acres of hardwood dominant forest as all other districts combined. But there's more to the story than that. Take a look here at the age distribution of hardwood dominant stands on the Tillamook district. We'll see that due to a variety of factors, forest management, since the Tillamook burn is focused heavily on conifer stands, largely avoiding management in these hardwood stands. This has ultimately yielded pronounced age distribution amongst the hardwood stands. Now let's factor in the expected life cycle of red alder. Somewhere around 60 to 80 years old, this species begins to decline and rarely lives past 100 years. The Tillamook district has 65,000 acres of hardwood dominant stands, and that's not even counting the conifer hardwood mixes. But those hardwood dominant stands alone account for more than a quarter of the district. Most of that is red alder, and while much of that looks reasonably healthy right now, is at an age where crown dieback will soon start to outpace new growth. We're talking about 65,000 acres here. An area that's mostly within the perimeter of the Tillamook burn. It's an area the size more or less of the Mount Hood Wilderness and constitutes a full 10% of the entire assessment area. If you project that forward another 20 years or so, looking at where the pulse is here and when the tree will start to climb, we're likely to have a lot of dead trees on our hands.
So Jeff, what you're saying there is that once these stands start to age and die off, then the fire potential is going to increase dramatically.
That may impact fire potential. I hadn't really thought of it in that context. But generally speaking, they're going stagnant on the landscape. They tend to get brush underneath them as the alder is dying, which inhibits this natural regeneration of the conifer species. And eventually, probably conifer would come through, but it'd take a while.
The dominance of alder on the total, is it because of the burns?
In large part, it is. It may also just be a natural propensity of some of those sites that are quite distinct in terms of soils and slope and other things compared to with our other North Coast districts.
Move the microphone, yeah, it'll help see you when you're answering that question. Move to the other side of you, so it's a little closer to your right side of you.
Try to
lean into it.
So lean into it. Small right, isn't it?
Small right. Small right.
So
this, looking at the forest by district, by types, by ages, is critical. And then when you look at one part with type, red alder, it becomes a question that, again, I'm not, it's not my district, but it becomes a real question for how to properly manage this for both fire as well as what do we help reforest if we help reforest? What do we help reforest? Do we, in fact, try to mix the hardwoods? You bring up a whole series of questions that I want to dig into. I won't, but it's just, this is good background. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's why we're bringing it up when you factor in slope situation in the Tillamook district, you factor in the hardwood, the hardwood situation really is fundamentally different, and obviously there are silviculture and economic implications of those differences. Yeah. So let's move on to forest health, although we're kind of there already. State forest lands, forest health can be ascertained by long-term trends and damage from major disturbance agents, including disease, insects, weather, and invasive species. While there are many more forest health issues that we could discuss here, we believe that twist needle cast, laminated root rot, and drought are some of the most pressing issues at this time. So twist needle cast. Twist needle cast is a foliage disease specific to Douglas fir that causes premature loss of needles. In severe cases, infected trees cast any needles that are older than the current growing season. By comparison, unaffected Douglas fir trees typically retain their needles for 4 years or more. This premature loss of needles reduces overall tree vigor, with annual growth reductions of 20 to 50% common in moderately to severely affected stands. While found in all Douglas fir forests, this disease is particularly problematic within a 28-mile zone that extends eastward from the coast. This includes about 550,000 acres of state forest land. The affected area with visual twist needle cast symptoms seen from annual aerial surveys of coastal Oregon set new record highs every year from 2011 through 2016. And there's mounting concern that twist needle cast is increasing in severity, frequency, and range in association with rising winter temperatures and spring precipitation. This will likely continue to intensify over the 21st century due to climate change. This graph over here depicts twist needle cast detection in northwest Oregon, west Oregon, and Bruce, with a 3-year average trend line. With our 2018 aerial survey recently completed, we've now seen about a 90% increase in affected acres since 2010. While this is lower than the peak in 2015, we can expect areas of predominantly Douglas fir to continue to show signs of infection, especially when coupled with climate change. Should be noted that while not shown on the graph, the 2016 and 2018 aerial surveys detected twist needle cast in the Cascades, which is far outside of the 28-mile coastal zone where it has traditionally been observed.
Really? And it's growing in the Cascades?
Excuse me?
The disease is growing in size in the Cascades?
I'm not sure. Do you want to answer that?
I can answer that. In 16 and 18, we saw it, and the Swiss needle cast call-up at ODF is a member of started ground shooting that in 2017, and we did pick up in Cascades. And then recently, we were up in Forest, Washington, and they hadn't really seen the Swiss needle cast follow there. And we're starting to see that because the rivers have just been warmer and we're getting more precipitation, which is allowing the normal spores just to spread in the range. So we are seeing it spread.
So this is no longer just a case of off-site seeding. Birds. This is because of the growing or the
warming of the atmosphere?
I think it's both. And with what we did is we took our spur to a zone that was dominated by hemlock and sitka spruce. So while it does have an inherent tolerance for some of that area, by putting it in as a monoculture as we did, and it has been done in Washington, we're just adding more food for the fungus to eat. And so that's why we're seeing it. And then with the warmer temperatures, it's just their trees are constantly being bombarded by it.
So you're making a rather casual connection between global warming and sophisticated past. Have there been any kinds of things done by OSU or anyone that are connecting that, or is this just a connection that you have made?
The researchers started to say that, especially with the 2017 paper that came out connecting climate change against sophisticated past and then modeling it, and so we will be modeling that in the future. A lot of the classic research on Swiss geocast wasn't about climate change, it was about understanding the disease and its effect on bubble spur. And so now that we kind of understand that, researchers at OSU and elsewhere are starting to factor in climate change with that. And they're using EPA as well as OSU scientists on that. And
I certainly understand. I think what I'm saying here is that, especially in the early stages of scientific research, be careful when you make that connection as a true positive connection. We're still maybe a little uncertain.
Yeah, we can be more uncertain, absolutely, but we do have papers out there that have been published in peer review connecting to fascinating climate change. That's not something that we came up with.
We'll cover this in a moment with the drought conditions in Oregon, but generally speaking, as trees are stressed in drought, they're more susceptible to all sorts of diseases, including Swiss-Cane cast. So the previous slide demonstrated that the majority of affected acres were concentrated in northwest Oregon. This map here on the left highlights the impacts on our ownership when viewed from the lens of district boundaries. At about 54,000 acres that were detected in 2018, 48,000, so about 90%, are located in northwest Oregon, specifically on the Tillamook and Story districts. Looking at the graph, 36,000 acres occur on the Tillamook district, about 14% of that district, and another 12,000 acres occur on the Story district, it's about 10% of that district. Between the ages of 40 and 79, when stands are traditionally available for commercial thinning or final harvest, some 21,000 acres of Tillamook stands are experiencing annual growth or death reductions of 20 to 50%.
So do you have any current thinking on why the huge differences between the Euphoria and Tillamook districts?
I think that's generally going back to that forest type, that Douglas fir is the susceptible species. The Story district has a lot more hemlock and resistant species mixing in. A lot of Tillamook District is also closer to the coast than our holdings in Clatsop County.
There's more to it than that, though. The Tillamook District had more forest fires than Clatsop District did, and so the off-site species were brought in that are more susceptible to Swiss-Cane.
Sure.
That's a factor.
And if you look here, I mean, you're looking, again, back to that Tillamook burn area, and always know the seed that was put in there, but much of that off-site seed is at least potentially more susceptible.
So an additional question on Swiss needle cast. So when Swiss needle cast trees are removed, there's a multi-conifer species and broadleaf species that are replanted. Question is, the Doug fir disease-resistant trees that are planted, how are they holding up to Swiss needle cast? Do you have any information on that?
No, we just started redeploying that seed ourselves, and so Tillamook District specifically has been getting all Swiss needle cast resistant seed for about 5 years. So it's still really too early for us to know how that is. We have seen them, progeny test sites respond well, but it's still going to be a little bit of a reduction. The key is, if you are planting Swiss needle cast zones, to give yourself options. So you're coming in with some numbers first, though, because it could be Swiss needle cast could be microclimatic. You see it worse on south-facing zones, for example. But you also come in with other species, so that way you have to do a management option. You have Douglas fir there, and if it's healthy, you can be there, but if you don't, you're moving it. And so that's how we're shooting it in Swiss needle cast.
in here in your presentation. So I think if you're going to talk about the connection between climate change and Swiss state gas, I think we also need to be talking about the issue of the replanting after the bighorn with non-native vector species and how they're more susceptible to Swiss state gas. Again, as much information as we can get out of it, it's going to be important to be holding that information back.
Yeah, you agree. There's a big Swiss state gas kind of blob down outside of Washington, Oregon. It's called the Mary's Peak Blob, that we call it. And that was planted with native seed as well. And so I agree that this is an off-site issue, but that's not the whole story.
And yeah, thank you for the feedback. The trauma of burn is certainly a very big part of the story that we're telling today, and we'll connect that with a map later on in the presentation. So let's move on to laminated root rot. This is the most damaging root disease in the Pacific Northwest and one of the most difficult to control. It's estimated to cause annual losses of 32 million cubic feet of wood throughout Western Oregon. Laminated root rot can be distinguished from other root diseases that cause similar crown symptoms by the characteristic decay of roots and buds. Decayed wood separates readily in the annual rings with pits on both sides of the sheets, and decayed roots make the trees susceptible to windthrow. This disease affects all our districts to varying degrees. Pre-harvest surveys can help detect the disease, and when detected, reforestation activities will focus on planting more resistant species.
See, this was, I thought I understood this issue. I was surprised to see that Douglas fir is susceptible to the extent that it is. I didn't know that.
I think the true firs maybe get the worst rap for that, but yeah, we see a lot of it in Douglas fir. Finally, we come to drought. Droughts take a major toll on all Oregon's forests and is often the primary cause of dead branches and treetops. Drought creates water stress inside the tree, which can reduce growth and vigor and even cause mortality. Drought-stressed trees are vulnerable to attacks from secondary agents such as insects and pathogens. Damage is typically most severe on fringe or forested areas and on shallow, rocky, or droughty soil types. The current trends showing decreasing average temperatures and decreasing average precipitation are forest towards springs in longer summer conditions, resulting in increasingly negative impacts of drought on Oregon state forests.
That's another issue I wasn't fully aware of.
Pardon me?
Drought, the impact of drought. So this is new information for me too.
Yeah, it takes time, but it does affect the trees, and again, very often it's those secondary agents that are causing the mortality, but the underlying cause is the drought. So this map series here highlights the stresses experienced in drought throughout Oregon. Drought density is assessed in the third week of August for every year since 2012. The severity of drought on the map increases with darkness of color, so white means no drought, and dark red means exceptional drought. So the drought in 2012 was mainly in southeast Oregon, outside the geographic scope of this assessment, but it is a precursor of 3 years ago. 2013, North Cascade, West Oregon, Western Lane, Coos are all affected. 2014, the majority of forest land was at least abnormally dry, with some districts experiencing moderate drought. And then by 2015, all districts are experiencing severe drought, with portions of West Oregon, Western Lane, and Coos experiencing extreme drought. It should also be noted that from 2013 through 2015, Oregon experienced both record drought and record fire years. Again, most of that is occurring on the southern part of our ownership, which was mentioned earlier.
And that was also due to the record water temperatures and record biofunctions.
I don't know.
But again, very often the drought is the underlying factor that's playing out across the landscape in a variety of ways.
It's on the climate.
you know, we haven't had that for some time.
I think you're right, that's not you, though, because the Deschutes got hit hard that year.
Yeah.
So anyway, if you look at 2016, all of our districts were still experiencing abnormally dry, moderate conditions. 2017 actually got a little bit of reprieve, but nowhere near enough to undo 4 years of stress. And then here's 2018. 62% of the state and all of our west side forest lands are currently in severe drought. This is exposing our forests to prolonged periods of water stress, decreasing their vigor, and predisposing them to enhance their secondary ages. And not surprisingly, Oregon is currently experiencing numerous large wildfires. So here's a little bit of a summary about some of the key points that we discussed in the forest condition.
Thompson, to what extent is drought related to the algae that pushes which El Nino, La Nina impacts?
Oh, we need a climatologist for that. I don't know that specifically.
I forget too. But
yes, one creates a lot less winter rain than the
El Nino brings the rains and the La Nina brings the drier.
Yeah, we are coming out of a moderate La Nina year this year, so that could explain some of the drought we're seeing right now.
May or not, all the global warming could be a normal
shift
from those two weather patterns.
Yeah, this isn't intended to be a statement on climate change. It's to demonstrate that
there is a drought and it's impacting our forests.
But if the weather patterns continue, the trees that we're talking about depend on a certain amount of water conditions, and if those conditions continue to veer off from what the original is, we in the future may be looking at different types of trees that are needed than what we have now. If I can recommend that in the future, but
certainly.
And that's one of the fears. That's one of the fears that we won't have the conditions to grow the trees like we're growing now.
That's certainly a possibility. Yeah. Finally, a quick summary of the forest condition, forest health section. Oregon State Forests currently have an uneven age distribution. The forest composition and age distribution vary by forest type and by district. Different forest types vary in their potential for timber production and wildlife habitat development. Red alder is prevalent in the Tillamook District, and most of that red alder is approaching the age at which it begins to decline. And finally, all of the state forest districts face similar forest health issues, but Swiss needle gas is disproportionately impacting the Tillamook District.
If you could put, with the Tillamook red alder in decline, and you might put slash due to age and maturity,
On the slide right there.
Yeah, because the people looked at it and go, well, why? And so if you say that, then it quickly, with just two or three more words, explains it.
And explain two or three more words.
Yeah. I have a question about the red alder. You see the life cycle of the tree. What is expected to replace the red alder as it matures out? What will they be replaced with more red alder, or is there another tree
theoretically, under natural unmanaged conditions, it would be considered a pioneer species. So maybe it would come in for 68 to 100 years after the burn, and eventually some conifer would start to replace it. That wouldn't be the case everywhere in some of your river corridors and whatnot. But the process by which that occurs would be quite slow. So the expectations on, say, the 20-year horizon or so is that all the trees start to die, there's going to be a lot of brush, sandberry in particular, underneath it, and some conifer will try to get through that brush, but it might take several decades before it's successful.
But I would say that, you know, understanding the condition out there is step one, and the extent of it and where that's taking us for forest productivity, but these are actively managed lands, and so
how would those areas, develop over time if we weren't managing them is one scenario. But the truth is we are managing them, and so taking this into account, we'll be looking for ways that we can really turn those stands into a long-term productive resource for the county.
So this is a picture of where we're at now.
Correct.
And then the plan will address what you're seeing on the ground and where you want to go.
You got it. Exactly.
Thank you.
And that's why, and so as this information plays out, we're really going to have to think around, each district has its own sort of, story. So how do we have a plan that allows us to do things a little bit differently in different districts is what we're proposing as a team. But there's challenges with that too in policy.
Perhaps I misunderstood, but I thought that about 50% of the total portfolio was kind of in a set-aside and not for active timber harvest. So it would be kind of interesting to see the proportion of, dominant species on the landscape, how much of that is in the, it's not even throughout of the 50%, but you say it's going to be actively managed, whereas my experience would maybe say that species might be in a predominantly set-aside area that might help you.
Yeah, we don't, set-asides aren't really a tool that we use on state forests. So, for example, when we have northern spotted owls, we establish owl circles around, and we can manage in those portions we can. So that's, of the set-aside type outcome. Marble murrelet areas, that's a different situation. No management allowed within those, but we can fit a buffer.
I'm just thinking that those are probably in riparian areas, stream sides.
Yeah.
So you can see that a lot of that is going to come to.
Yeah, sure, gorgeous.
That's right. And so that's really good input, and we can characterize the forest conditions in that 50% landscape. Yeah. And in fact, we've done it, and we did it several years ago, so we have that available pretty quickly.
With your presentation.
If there's no more questions, I'll pass it off to
We're gonna pass it off to Frank.